Hey everyone, Tuesday, Kiki here. We know all of you guys, us included, are going through a lot with the coronavirus going around. Some of you are in quarantine, self-isolation, the social distancing, as they're calling it. It's a very trying time for everyone, even those of you who are still going to work in this time. So we're hoping that for right now we give you just a few hours of entertainment, just to distract yourself, let you forget about your worries for just a little while, and enjoy two friends talking to each other about something we love.
Yeah, guys, we just want you to stay home. Seriously, please stay home and listen to the backlog. Join us on social media. Request episodes you want to hear during this time. We'll be happy to give them to you. And we got some interesting stuff that we're planning for the duration. So stay tuned in and stay safe.
And now our feature presentation.
I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Aloha, Kiki!
Aloha, Tuesday!
We're going to Hawaii! Kind of.
Hey, we figured out that laser thing. They have digitized us and sent us to Hawaii.
Only we're now cartoons. I don't know how that worked.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. I've always wanted to be a cartoon. I don't know about you.
Cartoons live forever. We can make this work.
Yeah, no. And my wardrobe, I've already got like seven of the same outfits, so...
Guys, we are talking about Lilo and Stitch, a movie that I love and a movie that Kiki has not seen before, or at least before this rewatch.
Yeah, I for some reason I've got some very strange gaps in my Disney watching history, as you will come to learn over the course of the podcast, I'm sure, but Lilo and Stitch just happened to be one of mine, despite my love for science fiction and my love for animation, and always kind of enjoying the idea of, you know, a cute little alien on Earth with a kid or whatever. This one, I don't know why I have never seen it till now. It's one of those that I've always intended to see, and it just never did.
Yeah, this was during a weird part of Disney's animation history. There's been many names given to this era. The kindest name I've heard was the experimental era, and that kind of describes this era to a T. So many movies were trying to do different things, different storytelling elements, different, you know, trying to do something that wasn't the Broadway musical formula, because at that time, as much as I personally like that formula, the general audience has kind of gotten tired of it, as we saw with, you know, but Hercules and Tarzan didn't really do so well in the box office. So they tried something new, and it wasn't really doing that well either. Like the new storytelling elements wasn't working. So Eisner, what I would call, did pulling a Dumbo, and what I mean by that is, Walt Disney had lost a lot of money on Fantasia and Pinocchio, and they needed to make a movie on the cheap, and that's where Dumbo came from. Same thing with Lilo and Stitch. They had lost a lot of money. They needed to make a movie on the cheap to hopefully recoup some of those lost revenue. And here we have Lilo and Stitch. And honestly, Lilo and Stitch is one of the most successful movies of that era. And if you haven't seen before, do so, and you'll know why. Because this movie is very small. For a movie that has aliens in it, it's very small. And it works because it's so small, confined to the Hawaiian Islands, in this one
specific
island.
One, yeah, specifically one island, yeah.
Yeah, and it works because of it. It's a small story that has a lot of heart in it. The theme of family is so prevalent in here, and it just works so well. For someone who who this was their first time watching the film, what were your general thoughts of the film?
I really did enjoy it. It was a little bit different in the way it went than I expected. Even in all these years, you know, I've heard a lot about the movie, and it's not like I've tried to stay away from spoilers or anything, but parts of the movie were still surprising to me. I really didn't expect the other two aliens that ended up on Earth, you know, to be quite like they were. I had completely gotten the wrong idea of the Ving Rhames character, Bubbles. And, you know, little snippets I had seen and memes and stuff like that. So it was kind of interesting getting context for some of the things I had sort of seen out of context. I am going to say, though, that I'm very annoyed that they saved Stitch talking for the most part for the last like 20 minutes or whatever the movie. Well, because to me, he was a lot cuter with dialogue. He was a much more interesting as a character with dialogue. He was, I don't know, barely better than a prop, I think, in some of those scenes before that. But he actually became like a character in that last act, which I think might have helped me relate to him a little bit earlier in the movie. And I kind of wish that he would have been, you know, do the thing where, like, the kid is absolutely certain he can talk and all the adults are like, eh, no, sweetheart, you're just imagining, you know, so that the audience can hear him talk and Lilo can hear him talk. But, like, you know, who's going to believe the little kid, you know? I think that would have worked a little bit better.
So let's kind of get into it a little bit. I want to talk a bit about the advertising for this movie. That all the commercials for this movie was Stitch interrupting other movies.
Yeah, it was really, really, I do remember the ad campaign, and it was kind of funny.
Because you have the epic scene from Beauty and the Beast, the Beauty and the Beast ballroom scene, and there's Stitch on the chandelier pulling it down and almost killing Belle and the Beast.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, for those of you who may not remember, but, like, people of our generation will remember, like, we had gotten so used in the late 80s and all through the 90s, and this movie came out, like, 2002, so we're just coming off that. Yeah. Of just occasionally you'd be watching TV and, like, a trailer for Cinderella would come on, and then it would be like, coming back from the Disney vault for like 2 months, Cinderella, you know. And the Renaissance movies were getting to that point now where we were expecting them to go into and out of the Disney vault like that. So bringing some of these movies back, like Beauty and the Beast, and all, and you would watch it and you'd be like, oh, okay, here's the commercial that's going to be like, it's going into the Disney vault in a month, go get your VHS now, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. We were already primed as an audience for that to work. Because you would always stop and look at the commercial at least the first time so you would know what the timeline was. Mm-hmm. At least I did. If you were a Disney fan, you would absolutely want to know the schedule of what was going to be on shelves when. So paying attention to the Disney Vault commercials was kind of a thing we were already conditioned to do. And then using that idea of, like, hey, are you worried about Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin or something going into the Disney Vault? Oh, it's Stitch, you know?
Like, yeah.
I really loved that ad campaign. And I honestly really do not know why I did not go see this in theaters, because I was still, you know, kind of the obligatory, well, it's a Disney film and I have to go see it in theaters. And the only thing I can think of is that this opened the same weekend as a Spielberg movie. And if there was one thing I was a bigger fan of in my childhood than Disney, it was Spielberg, especially at this point in time. So that's the only thing I can think back to of why I might have actually missed this one. So I don't know.
My favorite one of those commercials is the Aladdin one. It's the scene of Whole New World and they're doing the magic carpet thing. And here comes Stitch and his little spaceship. And just Mr. Steal Your Girl, take Jasmine off, and they're going off into space, leaving Aladdin high and dry. Like, hey, you got a magic carpet? Well, I got a flying car. Let's go.
I absolutely loved one of the teaser posters for Lilo and Stitch. And in fact, it's the one they use on Wikipedia. So if you go look at Lilo and Stitch on Wikipedia. But it's Stitch sitting front and center and all the Disney Renaissance characters and also Pinocchio and Dopey. Is it Dopey or Sneezy or something? One of the dwarves.
Yeah.
Yeah. But mostly Disney Renaissance characters, like cowering in fear from Stitch, and it says there's one in every family. Which I absolutely love that idea of using the other characters to, you know, because Stitch isn't your normal Disney character for most of the movie.
No.
And so I love that idea of the counterpoint of like, hey, we're Disney and we're going to try something a little bit different. This isn't a fairy tale. This isn't taken off some old piece of media. This is an original idea. It's an alien, which Disney had not done in a little bit.
And it was a story taking place in the modern day, which, again, Disney was not known as doing back then.
Yeah, we had a lot of, like, you know, this is set in 1600s Europe somewhere or whatever. But I think the closest to modern day that Disney had gotten in the recently before Lilo and Stitch was probably Tarzan.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the one that was the closest to modern day.
Was Meet the Robinsons before or after this?
I cannot remember. But yeah, and the idea to set it in Hawaii was also a big deal at the time. Because they had not ever done anything in, like, the Pacific Islands or anything really in Hawaii. There weren't any really big Hawaiian Disney characters or anything.
No. Or even Polynesian characters at all. Again, this was a good...
No Polynesian characters.
This was a good decade and a half before Moana.
Yeah. So the idea to set it there really caused a lot of excitement around it. I think a lot of, like, you know, Native Islanders and stuff like that were really happy to see something portraying any part of their culture, you know. Modern or in the past, just as I think there was a big, you know, same thing about Moana, you know, that a lot of people were like, oh, good, we finally get stories about us to be told.
Yeah, it's, again, a rarity that is a Disney character, a main Disney character of color.
Yeah, because it does absolutely look like the three main human characters in this all have actual Hawaiian ancestry, not just people who were raised on the Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. Which even today there is a very big distinction. Mm-hmm. But it does look like they actually do have Hawaiian heritage. And I do like that not everybody on the island looks like they have Native Hawaiian heritage. there are also like very obviously white characters whose parents or grandparents immigrated to the islands at some point. Mm-hmm. But so I like that it's a mix. You know, you do kind of see the mix of it's not just a movie about Native Hawaiian Islanders. It's not just a movie about, you know, white people who moved to the islands or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's a movie about kind of modern Hawaii as it exists now as a U.S. state.
Yeah.
You know, which I kind of liked. But another part of this was that there had just been an economic downturn that had hit the islands really badly, which is why Nani is so struggling for work and stuff throughout most of the movie, is that that was apparently a pretty common problem at the time on the islands, and especially if you weren't on the big island, you know. It's like,
and especially at this time 2002, you know, September 11th just happened and tourism went way down everywhere. So
the time it came out, yeah, but are we gonna talk about the controversy? We might as well, since we just brought it up.
Yeah, the entire third act of this movie was changed because of September 11th.
Yeah, because, I mean, remember how long it takes to do an animated movie. This was in production, you know, by, like, 99 or whatever, I think, when they really kicked into gear. Mm-hmm. And as they were coming close to finishing the movie and getting it ready for release, 9/11 happened. And you want to describe what the third act originally was?
Third act features Stitch and Stitch, Nani, and the other two aliens stealing a Boeing 747, flying it through the city.
Yeah, yeah, it would have been the one urban scene in the entire movie, because the rest of the movie is set kind of farther away from the big cities on the island.
Yeah, a rural area. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a much more rural area for most of the movie. But yeah, that would have been the one big urban scene, and they had almost animated that entire thing.
You can see the animated. This scene is, for the most part, complete, and you can actually see this on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
There are actually two versions of the scene. One is the storyboard version, and one is the actual animated version with the full level voice actors. And they salvaged this by changing. The 747 was a CG model, so all they did was change out the CG model, change it to make it look like it's more of a spaceshipy kind of thing rather than a Boeing 747.
But also, that's why that's like the largest spaceship we see.
Yes.
In the entire film, because compared to the bad guy they're chasing at the time. Yeah. That ship is hulking, and I'm like, why would you give a convicted criminal and an idiot bureaucrat that large and massive a ship to go infiltrate a planet that cannot know there's aliens?
Yeah, but and that was their way of saving that scene. And yeah, they changed the background. Obviously, they changed it from a...
Yeah, they had to repaint all the backgrounds.
Yeah, so it went from a urban landscape to a mountain landscape. And I think that actually makes it better, as it keeps it in that rural area.
Yeah, I think the original one would have caused a lot of, like, but, you know, I mean, granted, they would have been in an Earth, you know, vehicle, mm-hmm, but it's like, there's going to be a lot of questions about mm-hmm that, you know, like, why, how can you keep Stitch a secret at the end of the movie while doing that, you know?
Well, you know, we'll call in the Men in Black and they'll neuralize everybody and there we go. But, yeah, let's... And there's also another scene that got changed for the most part, which is a scene where Jimba attacks the house. That scene did get some changes from the original animated version, mostly because there's a scene where Jimba is about to shoot Stitch. Stitch breaks the oven in Nani's house using the gas line, and you know what happens when a gun goes off in a gas-filled house? Boom!
Yep.
And they changed that because, well, that was also one of the 9/11 changes. Because
yeah.
The scene was very much realistic fire, and a scene of Lilo looking at her house on fire.
Yeah, and they made the whole scene in general a lot more comedic with the hot potato bit and, you know,
the explosion being green instead of red.
Yeah, Stitch having a lot more like one-liners, I think, in there.
Happy birthday! It's not my birthday. Merry Christmas! It's not Christmas. Happy Hanukkah!
Yeah. I think that they changed that a lot because I think originally, from what I've read, that whole sequence was a bit more serious. Like it was a proper action scene.
That scene is also on the Disney Plus version, if you can find it.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Disney Plus version, Disney Plus version also has one more difference that was not in the theatrical version. There's a scene where Lita was hiding from Nani, and in the Disney Plus version, she's hiding in a cabinet covered by a pizza box. On the original theatrical version, which I have on the original DVD, she hides in the dryer.
I honestly thought that she was still hiding in the dryer. I watched it on Disney Plus. I have never seen it before, and I was like, the girl just hid in the dryer.
Apparently that was
also shaped... what is draped over your dryer. Like, I didn't know it was a pizza box. I thought it was like a towel or something. Like they'd been doing laundry and it had just kind of fallen over. But I absolutely would not have called that a cabinet. To me, it still reads as dryer.
Yeah. Apparently that was changed for the international version because they didn't like the idea of Lilo hiding in a dryer.
Well, yeah, you don't want to tell kids that a dryer is a great place to hide. But they also cut out a bunch of stuff with Pudge the Fish.
Yes.
Who you never really meet in the movie as a character, but apparently you were supposed to, and Stitch was supposed to accidentally kill him.
Again, that's a deleted scene, not in the final film that I remember. But yeah, it was pretty much, you know, Pudge controls the weather, and... it was supposed to explain some weather anomalies in the area was because Pudge died.
Yeah, which they cut out entirely, and I'm kind of glad. But I don't know. They changed. This was one of those, like, Beauty and the Beast that went through an entire reworking of part of the plot.
Again, they had a good reason to.
Well, yeah, but honestly, I'm not even sure that was like due to 9/11 or anything. But Stitch was not originally like a creation that had been, you know, like a genetic monster or whatever. He was just like a bad alien, and he was like a criminal alien who had a gang. And Jumbo was supposed to be his like second in command or something that. The council sends out to get Stitch in, you know, as like a you go do this and we'll wipe away your crimes kind of thing, because he knows Stitch better because he worked with him. And then the test audiences really did not like that. They really didn't like the idea of like reformed criminal Stitch because it wasn't so much a nature versus nurture story then. It was like, can you reform a hardened criminal story? Which I don't, you know, it's obvious that whatever test audiences they showed it to thought that it didn't work. And honestly, I think that, you know, my feelings on the prison industrial complex aside, maybe that's a little too complicated a story for the age group that they were.
Yeah.
You know, I think little kids can kind of understand the nature versus nurture debate in some shallow way.
This is also the second animated movie to be completely done at the Disney MGM Studios, the first being Mulan.
So oh, yeah. Flor- yeah.
yeah. the Florida team gets another chance to shine here.
Yeah, do we want to talk about what the animation looks like?
Go ahead.
Because they went back to kind of an older thing. You know, they had been leaning so heavily into the new CG technology. But they went back, especially for the backgrounds. The backgrounds are all like a watercolor aesthetic. It looks a lot like a kid's storybook, you know, like a picture book for kids. And that was intentional because the idea of Stitch as a character started from a failed storybook that the creator Chris Sanders had been working on. And it had never found its footing as a children's book. And so he brought the idea to Disney when they came to him and asked if he had any ideas. So they went back to a very early Disney style. But they changed the kind of medium. So they went back to the hand-painted style, but traditionally Disney would have used a paint called gouache, which is an incredibly old technique. And honestly, I'm familiar with it because it's what we use in medieval reenactment to do illuminated scrolls and things like that. But they went for these kind of very thin, brightly colored, you know, watercolor things. And it looks gorgeous. The backgrounds in this are amazing. The other difference is they didn't use the Disney style for the animation. Chris Sanders had his own personal style that he had done when he had done the illustrations for the Never To Be book. And so he had all the animators be retrained in his personal style.
And this kind of caused problems with him in Disney. Several of the higher-ups were not happy about this because they had a style, they had a way they wanted to do it, and Chris Sanders was doing something different.
The experimental age.
Yeah.
You know, the experimental era, they really did. And this does not look at all like your typical Disney film. Everything about the way this is done does not read Disney. If you didn't know it was a Disney property and somebody told you that this had come out of Fox Animation at the time...
Or DreamWorks,
Or DreamWorks, maybe. Or, you know, one of the other kind of animation players at the moment, you would have absolutely believed it because they did not have as much of a set style. They were willing to play around a little bit more. But the fact that Disney did this was kind of interesting and impressive.
Yeah, at this point, John Lasseter had been brought in. I believe Bob Iger was already in charge at this point.
Yeah.
And he brought Lasseter in. Yeah, they already bought Pixar. Lasseter was brought in to kind of oversee Disney's animation. And him and Sanders just did not get along. And which eventually led to Chris Sanders leaving Disney, going to DreamWorks and doing a little movie called How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, Disney has the history at this point of just having animators go like, well, fine, I'll go do my own thing, and then being ridiculously good at
with
whatever
card
their
games
own thing
and
is. Yeah,
with card games and how am I going to make this PG? How am I going to make that line PG?
Fun female friends. I don't know. But I find it interesting how much of animation was helped by Disney being not nice to specific people in there. You know, we wouldn't even have DreamWorks as a company if they'd been a little bit nicer to Katzenberg. You know, it's like...
Yeah.
And then, you know, we wouldn't have How to Train Your Dragon if they'd have been a little more open to Sanders. You know, we wouldn't have Pixar at all if they'd have been a little nicer to us. I mean, Disney ended up on the better end of that because they reacquired it, but still.
But they still brought Sanders back to do all the sequels and the TV show as Stitch, just not as a creative grunt.
But I don't know. I mean, I really think that this was maybe they should have been a little bit nicer to him because this is a good property for them.
Let's kind of get into that. You know, Dean DeBlase and Chris Sanders were the directors of this movie. Sanders was the creator of creator of the character of Stitch. He voices Stitch, which is for a Disney movie at this point in time to have a non-big name person voice a main character was weird. It's not something Disney did.
Yeah, this is a big departure. And yeah, he really wasn't a voice actor. It wasn't like he had, you know, 'cause some animators are also voice actors. We know a few. Sanders, I'm not really sure was. I didn't really find anything in his background that suggested he had any real career on the side as a voice actor until this.
And of course, Chris Sanders voices Stitch. And for someone who really isn't known as an actor, like you said, during that third act, he really does get that wholesomeness into Stitch during that final act.
Yeah, I absolutely loved the portrayal of Stitch. I thought that the voice was great. And in fact, I didn't look up who was doing the voice until afterwards, and I was very shocked. There's a lot of emotion in that performance. I mean, there's a couple of things Stitch says that I was like crying over.
I'm lost.
Yeah, and I'm here looking for my family, and you know, it's I don't know, it's there's some good stuff in there. I mean, bravo to you, Mr. Sanders. You really did bring it there.
And they are bringing Chris Sanders back for the upcoming Disney Plus remake of the film to voice Stitch again. So that's it's like the Frank Welker thing. Be so good at being a character that they can't recast you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bravo to him. He has found his niche in Stitch. Ha ha ha.
So let's talk about the other characters. That would be Lilo herself, voiced by DeVay Chase. And her resume is kind of huge. She was
Yeah.
Samantha Darko in Donnie Darko. She was Samara in The Ring. Just that by just those two, if you haven't seen those two movies, what are you doing here?
Yeah. She was an incredible, if you ever watched the HBO series Big Love, she played a character called Rhonda, who was an absolute psychopath. I mean, she was so good. It was like one of those, like, again, it was like Samara in The Ring. And she's very good at, or at least she was when she was that age. She's pushing 30 now, but at the time, she was very good at playing creepy child.
Which
Which
works for Lilo.
yeah, it really does. When we were given this movie as our this week's request by our guest from last week, Adam described Lilo as a neuroatypical character. And watching the movie, I thought, yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, this character displays some of the major neurodivergent markers. And
Definitely not
I
your
think,
typical Disney character.
Yeah, or even just typical animation character. I'm not sure I've seen a character portrayal like Lilo ever. I mean, really. And I think DeVay Chase was a good person for that. I don't really want to get into characterization right now because we're still kind of doing the pre stuff. But I think she was good for that. Because she could bring a little bit of that, like, creepy, offbeat child that she'd been so good at playing into, what if it was a kind-hearted, wonderful girl, but she just sees the world a little bit differently?
And one of the few children in an animated movie that acts like a child.
Yes, Lilo actually gets to act like a child. You do not feel like this is an adult writing a child, and I had just watched a movie about 2 hours before I sat down to watch this that had a child who was like 8 but talked like they had a PhD. And it can be a funny trope if used correctly, but it's not how most children relate to a character. If you're trying to get children to relate to a character, that's not the way to do it. You know, kids relate to kids who speak like kids, I think.
Let's move on. We got Tia Carrere as Lilo's older sister Nani. And Tia Carrere, again, at this point in time, was a pretty in-demand actress.
Yeah, she had a pretty good career going there. Her 90s, that entire decade for her was amazing.
I
I
mean,
mean,
if you haven't seen Wayne's World, do so.
yeah. And of course she was in True Lies. She was in Cole the Conqueror with Kevin Sorbo. Maybe not the brightest point of her career. I mean, the Wayne's World thing really just launched her into superstardom. If you weren't in the movie-going audience during the 90s, you do not know what an absolute cultural behemoth that was. But it really got her. And she started, even though they weren't always starring roles, she was very in demand at kind of, A-level guest star, I guess, in a lot of movies.
And she's an actual Hawaiian, actual
Yeah.
native Hawaiian.
So this is it was really awesome for them to go out and like they tried to do with Pocahontas, for example. They went out and tried to find at least some actors that were of the ethnicity they were trying to portray, specifically her and Jason Scott Lee, who portrays David. I am not sure if Jason Scott Lee is actually has. Yeah, okay, it does look like he has Native Hawaiian in him, but he was definitely raised in Hawaii as well. So both of them had were of Native Hawaiian ancestry, and they were raised on the islands. So Disney basically gave the two of them the job of making it feel authentic to the way Hawaiians speak. So they added some kind of
Slang.
colloquialisms and slang and stuff like that just to make the dialogue feel more natural to people living on the islands. Which I love that Disney gave them that leeway, 'cause some studios will not. Some studios will be like, no, you read the line exactly as we wrote it. But I like that Disney was a bit flexible on that.
All right, let's move on. David Ogden Stiers as Jumba, the creator of Stitch. You might remember him. We talked about him before. He was Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, and Governor Ratcliffe in Pocahontas.
Yep.
Oh, and the Archdeacon in Hunchback, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he has a resume.
And a few roles that we haven't even gotten to yet.
Yeah. I don't think we can go further. I mean, that's enough. You guys can get the picture here.
And we got... Fun fact about David Ogden Stiers that I actually didn't know until recently. Mm-hmm. His first, like, on-screen work was in THX 1138, which was, like, George Lucas's first film anybody ever saw. A very interesting film if you've never seen it. And probably now owned by Disney as well, so I think that was part of the Lucasfilm catalog when Disney bought it, so maybe we'll cover that one day, who knows.
Maybe. And it's him doing a Russian accent. Or that Boris Badenoff kind of voice for Jumbo.
Yeah, it's more Boris Badenoff than it is like a legit Russian accent. It's very much like...
Introducing myself, I am Dr. Yeah. Jumbo, this is 626.
Yeah, it's that kind of overhyped thing. His sidekick, portrayed by somebody I am, like, absolutely adore, which is Kevin MacDonald, one of the members of the Kids in the Hall.
Yeah, Agent Pleakley.
Pleakley, yeah. And you may also know him if you're an Invader Zim fan. He is the almighty tallest purple. So, but yeah, he's got himself a little voice acting career going now, and he's actually really, really good at it. He's been one of those on-screen actors that actually takes the craft very seriously, and I do not consider him necessarily stunt casting because he has actually worked on being a voice actor. Just as much as being an on-screen actor. So I respect that. Good for you, Kevin. And they just announced that Kids in the Hall is coming back soon. I am psyched. Anyway.
Moving on. Yeah, and Pleakley being the Earth expert that is sent to Earth.
Yes.
To,
quote-unquote
yes, what?
Quote-unquote expert. Big giant air quotes around expert.
Yeah, that's part of the comedic, is that he's supposed to know everything there is to know about Earth, but what he knows about Earth is factually incorrect. Think of that one episode of Doctor Who, when they're on the Space Titanic. There you go.
Yeah.
Ving Rhames as Agent Cobra Bubbles.
Yeah, he does a good job with this.
Yeah.
But of course, he does... I'm impressed that the Ving Rhames persona... comes through with as little dialogue as Bubbles has. Because Ving Rhames has always been kind of a man of few words, but most of those words are filled in by his body language, which is hilarious because you can't do that, of course, as a voice actor, but somehow it still comes through, which I'm just, bravo to him.
What does Cobra Bubbles look like?
Well, yes, I mean, he does look like Ving Rhames, but you can't, you know, this isn't a motion capture movie.
I was making a Pulp Fiction joke.
I know, but, but it just, you know.
Okay, you know, yeah, Cobra Bubbles, there's a lot of, I mean, there's like, as before we get to the end where his kind of past is revealed, he's this big imposing character, like you said, he's in a way, sort of a villain, because he's the Child Protective Services agent. And he doesn't really look like your typical Child Protective Service agent.
Yeah, which is, I think, the first thing Nani says to him. It's like, you don't look like that, you know.
Yeah, it's like, and so it's like, and you find out everything about him at the end of the movie. But it's like, it's this character that, isn't, you know, why would this character be in CPS? But it's like, you know, and he says, yeah, you know, I'm the guy they call when things go wrong and things have gone very wrong. So it's like, that's kind of their way of saying this situation has gotten so big, we have to call this guy to fix it.
Yeah, we brought in the literal muscle.
Let's move on here to another sort of villain character, Kevin Michael Richardson as Captain Gantu.
Yeah, oh, Kevin Michael Richardson. I do not think we've had the ability to talk about him before.
No, I think this is his first, or the first Disney movie that he's did that we've talked about.
Yeah, that we've talked about. Kevin Michael Richardson is an absolute workhorse of a voice actor. You have heard him in everything. I mean, yeah. Everything. You know, he's done so many video games. He's in Knights of the Old Republic. He's in Halo 2. He's in the Baldur's Gate series. He is Crunch Bandicoot in the Crash Bandicoot games. You know, that's just, you know, a little bit of his video games. You know, he is, he eventually voiced the Joker in the animated series that was called The Batman.
Yep.
He is, he's Bill Cosby in the Boondocks. And he's the principal in American Dad. And he's everywhere, and he's very rarely the lead actor in anything he's in, but he's always that kind of, you know, much like, some of the other ones we've talked about on here, he is always the voice in the background that's filling out the cast. And once you hear his voice, you hear his voice everywhere, you know. So I love him. I love whenever he shows up, and I was so happy to hear him in this film, even though he didn't get nearly enough screen time, in my opinion, but, you know, whatever.
Yep. And let's keep on going. Zoe Caldwell as the Grand Councilwoman.
Yeah, a very well-known stage actress, but a lot of she later did a little bit of voice acting, but this primarily seems to be her big voice acting role. She was in, you know, like some other stuff, I think, but this was basically it. Almost entirely a theater actress, or, you know, those kind of like, and now PBS presents, you know, some play that we have filmed. Like, she's that woman. So,
And unfortunately, about a month ago, she passed away.
She did, but she had a long and very successful life. She was 86 when she passed, so, I mean, you know, that's good for her. May we all be so lucky.
And she will forever be immortalized in this Disney cartoon.
And also a few of, they brought her back for some of the other
the sequels and the TV show.
Yeah, the other projects for that. The last one I think we really want to talk about just shortly is Amy Hill, who is only in one scene. She is the little fruit seller woman that ends up with the watermelon on her head. She is an Asian American actress who is known for just kind of being that woman. When you need an older Asian American actress, she's kind of the go-to now. You know her voice acting as Mama Ling, Francine's mother in American Dad. You know her if you've ever watched Jackie Chan Adventures. She shows up again in the Lilo and Stitch series. That character comes back a lot. But she really made a splash on TV when she was the grandmother on a series called All American Girl in the 90s, which starred Margaret Cho and was one of the first vehicles for Asian American actresses on network television.
Yep.
So, you know, she's had a great career, and she is an incredibly funny comedian and a great actress who is most recently on the series Preacher. Mm-hmm. So
let's get into the plot of this movie. What is this movie about? We have Stitch, the experiment 626 of Dr. Jumba Dr. Jumba, because I cannot pronounce that name no matter how many times I've heard it. So, because it's an alien name. So Dr. Jumba creates Experiment 626, which apparently creating living beings is illegal in the Space Council, and has been arrested for it. And his creature is going to get destroyed. The creature escapes to this backwater planet called Earth. I don't know if you heard of it. Sounds like a dumb name.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust anything that comes from that planet.
No, and he lands conspicuously, or coincidentally, on the Hawaiian Islands and meets this strange little girl named Lilo, who adopts him as her pet dog. And hilarity ensues. And honestly, I mean that generally, this movie is a very funny movie.
It is very funny, and also, I think if you've ever been the weird kid, you immediately have, like, a spiritual connection to Lilo.
I thought you would like Lilo.
Yeah, I am very sad I have never seen this movie up until now, because Lilo is now, like, my fave. She makes her own doll, but it comes out weird, so she gives it, like, oh, no, I just decided she had surgery because she got worms in her ears or something, like...
Yeah.
And I was absolutely that kind of kid. It's like if Wednesday Addams were a little Hawaiian girl or something. It's very much in that kind of, she's not necessarily creepy. Like her things aren't necessarily creepy, but she's very focused on things I think people think little kids shouldn't be focused on.
She takes pictures of fat people in bathing suits.
But the interesting thing is that she doesn't do it to mock them. She legitimately thinks they're beautiful. And you know what? Kind of a screw you movie for making that seem weird.
Yeah.
You know, on behalf of fat people who wear bathing suits. You know, we get to enjoy the beach too, okay? But she isn't doing it for
exploitation
or a laugh or I found a really big one today or something. You know, it's a very loving. She really does think that all of the subjects of her photographs are beautiful, which I like. And again, boo to you, movie, for suggesting that they're not. They are very strangely, you know, as photography, you know, her lighting's always a little bit off and her framing is kind of weird. So you can take issue with them as photographs, I guess, but not her choice of subject.
And there's... My favorite background character, and I think everyone's favorite background character, is the ice cream guy.
Yes, the poor ice cream guy who is probably has skin cancer. I mean, let's just be honest.
That's not a good tan on him.
Yeah, no, it's not a tan. It's like you have deeply destroyed about 18 layers of your skin, my dude. The last severe burn I got at the beach, which was almost a year ago now, I still have the tan from, thanks to part of my heritage. But even I didn't look like that, and that was a severe burn that required some kind of out of the ordinary care for that one. But yeah, that poor guy, you know, get him in Tours and slather aloe on that poor man.
He never gets to enjoy his ice cream, though.
And he never gets to, you know, get him indoors, cover him with aloe, then hand him an ice cream. That's what we need for that dude. But yeah. Yeah, I love that dude too. That made me laugh so much, and also a little bit. Aww.
Even in the original change, you know, the original pre 9/11 version of the movie, he still loses his ice cream.
Oh yeah, yeah. They could have gone back and changed that. You could have changed that, Disney.
But that was part of the gag.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Lilo and Nani's background here and how they ended up in the situation they're in.
Because typical Disney trope.
Again, we get my least favorite Disney trope, dead parents.
We need a dead parents jingle for this show.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Dead parents aren't much fun. Disney. Interestingly, though, one of the reasons that I relate to Lilo is this is the first, shall we call her a Disney heroine? I think we shall. Disney heroine that has to deal with dead parents, that deals with it in a very realistic way. You get the idea that people like Belle and Ariel and stuff probably never really knew their mom. Like, they don't really have memories. Mm-hmm. You know, that maybe they were so young infants or early toddlers that it's just kind of a gray. Like, you had a mother, she was here, but, you know, you have no memories of her as a person. I don't know exactly how old Lilo is supposed to be.
I think she's supposed to be about 5 or 6.
Really? That young? I would have pegged her older, like 8 or 9. But I don't know what the official Disney word on that is. But
one of the characters drives a big wheel, so we can go in that direction.
Yeah, and to me that reads slightly older, but I don't know. I was also a weird child.
Single digits, we'll go with that.
Yeah. But apparently the official Disney line is that she is 5 years old in this movie, and then she ages up throughout the franchise. But
she has at least one birthday in this movie.
Yeah. But she is the first one that actually deals with this trauma like a real child deals with this trauma. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that are very common to children who lose at least one parent at a very early age. And it kind of changes depending on what age you are. And if you ever listen to the comedy of Pete Davidson, who lost his father in 9/11 when he was 7 years old, he talks about a lot of the same things. And I relate to that because even though I was a little bit older when I lost my mother, I went through a lot of the same things. And watching Lilo, I saw her going through a lot of the same things as well, which I think bravo to them for understanding that, because a lot of people do not understand that part of the trauma. So things like her desensitization, I guess, around things that are creepy or weird or have something to do with death, that tends to follow a lot. The slight kind of lack of trust in somebody, because you're always sort of expecting them to not be there the next day, whether they intend to or not, is pretty common, you know. So there's all these little, you know, the sense of like nobody wanting you enough, or else why would they leave? And the line that gets me the most, I mean, I had to, like, stop the movie and just have a moment, is, you know, closer to the end when Stitch is going out the window and she says, "I'll remember you. I remember everybody who leaves." which is a very common feeling, I think, for people. I mean, people who have been through that sort of trauma at any age, but I think especially if you're young, when it first happens, that becomes your, like, the only thing you have to hold on to is the memory. So that idea of her, like, sleeping with the picture of her family under her pillow and stuff like that, you know, I did very similar things as a child, and I was older, you know, but it all rings very true. So this is the first time that the kind of unfortunate dead parent trope in Disney has actually been treated with the weight and the appropriate psychological impact, I think. So it is one thing that I really, really, really want to give this movie props for, because bravo to them.
And let's talk about Nani a bit. You know, she's this young woman. We don't really know how old she's supposed to be.
I think she's supposed to be about 19, I think I read one point. She definitely has to be at least 18, because that would be the age that the U.S. would allow you to be a guardian of a child.
All right. So she's at least 18, 19 years old, so obviously not going to college, having to give that up to raise her little sister, and she's trying this hard, you know, kind of thrusted into this role of parent. Again, so she's dealing with this herself, you know, loss of her parents, and now she all of a sudden having become a parent herself and trying as hard as she can to kind of raise her sister in this environment. And she's trying, but she's not, it's kind of blowing up in her face.
Yeah.
The house is a mess. She's trying to cook dinner and it's going all wrong. She's trying to doing all this while also holding down a job.
Yeah, I'm seeing some things that say 18, some things that say 19, so I'm not sure what the official Disney word is, but she's just barely old enough that the government would consider her a legal guardian for a child.
Mm. And, you know, many people go with the sister aspect for Frozen. Well, it was kind of here first, but it's done in a different way, but it's definitely, you know, these two feel more like real sisters than Anna and Elsa does, at least to me.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that I read they had to go in and add a little bit of dialogue that made it a little more apparent that Nani is supposed to be her older sister, because a lot of audiences were like, oh, so if that's the mom, was it like the stepmom that died in the car crash? Or like, they weren't kind of getting it, because Nani really has worked on being sort of a motherly figure, so they had to go in and add a few things in order to make it absolutely clear that this is her sister that is now taking care of her. I don't know how it came across in the original cut, because, of course, I've never seen the original cut that they showed as audiences. But
yeah, that scene is out there. That I don't know if it's on Disney Plus, but that scene is out there where it's more of a story that Lilo says, and people kind of get confused because are we talking about, you know, of Nani being Lilo's mother? But yeah, they went back and put in a bunch of lines calling each other sisters, and there we are. But it works.
Yeah, no, it definitely works. And here's the interesting thing is that Disney had been, for a while, trying to cultivate, at least during like the Renaissance years for people of our generation, mm-hmm. Disney had been trying to cultivate some kind of connection with slightly older kids. You know, kind of those getting into their teens. And so they tried things, you know, like these action movies and like Treasure Planet and stuff like that. Like, oh, that'll appeal to the older crowd. And it never really worked. But what ended up appealing to the older crowd accidentally was Nani. You know, they made this movie for a younger audience. You know, it's supposed to be that kind of sweet spot animation range of like 7 to 12 or whatever. But Nani really resonated with the teens of kind of, because even if you're not the official legal guardian, I think, of your of your siblings, if you have younger siblings, I think your parents start giving you more responsibility and look after your brother or sister, you know. And I think a lot of kids, older kids, related to that. You know, of like, I love my siblings and I would do anything for them, but man, would I hate to all of a sudden be the parent, you know. And poor Nani, I mean, you know, she didn't ask for that. You know, it's implied that their parents' death was like really, really soon. No, I mean, like recent before the movie, because, you know, it couldn't have been more than a year. Or they wouldn't have let Nani be the guardian at all. So it had to be sometime probably shortly after Nani turned 18 and suddenly her parents are gone. And even when you're older, and, you know, both of us unfortunately know this, but, you know, even when you're older, having to do all the kind of end of life and post-mortem paperwork and stuff like that for a parent's estate is overwhelming no matter how old you are. And all of a sudden to have it at 18, which is when nobody's expecting that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. Did she start, had she even had a job before that? You know, I don't know. A lot of kids in the U.S. start working at 16, at least part-time. I don't know if she did, but, you know, what was that? You know?
Yeah.
And we call Bubbles a, not really a villain, but he is kind of an antagonist for them.
Yeah. He's not a really, I mean, like, he's trying to help them. There are times where you feel like he wants them to succeed. He wants them to make it.
Yeah. And they are very focused on Lilo, of course. But, you know, he says at one point as he's trying to remove Lilo from the house.
Yeah.
That he thinks Nani needs Lilo more than Lilo needs Nani. And I've always wondered, because I've known people who have had to deal with, you know, through no real fault of their own, just as it's no real fault of Nani's, a child being rehomed at least for a little while. And I always wonder, like, yes, we should be worried about the child, but the thing that always gets me is there's absolutely no assistance for the adult in that. You know, and if you want what's best for Lilo is obviously being with the last of her family. So why are we removing Lilo instead of helping Nani? You know, she never has government help in finding a job. You know, like the social worker is just like, find a job. Bubbles doesn't go like, here, let me take you down to the office and we'll, you know, let you look for work. You know, do you need access to a computer to look for work or what, you know, whatever it might be.
That wouldn't really make for a very interesting movie.
Well, no, I mean, just in real life. I mean, this is our world, just with aliens dropped into it. And I've always wondered, like, so where is the help for her? If her sister gets removed from her, do we have, like, mental health care for her? Do we have a path for her to get to the point where her sister can rejoin her in a year or two? Like, you know, what happens there? Because obviously, you know, Nani isn't a bad person. She's not abusing Lilo. She's not, you know, treating her in any kind of way. They do the kind of joking sister thing where she's like, oh, I'm going to stick you in a blender and I'm going to, you know.
Yeah.
But it's never, like, serious.
Malicious.
You know. The worst thing she ever does to Nani is like wrap her up in a blanket and take her to bed. You know, which is like, if that's the worst thing that ever happens to you, you have a charmed life. But,
but you know, through the movies, we do see that the two do love each other. They two don't want to be separated. They, you know, it's like, that they're
really. And Bonnie has everything she needs to be a good parent, except the financial end.
Mm-hmm.
She is fully capable of being a guardian for this child, except the finances. That's the last thing that she needs. And I always think of like, well, why don't we just find her a job? Like, why remove her, which is only going to make it worse for her in trying to get her life back in track, because now that's an extra emotional trauma she's been through. But it's like, we're focusing on the wrong thing here, people, which is not just, it's not at all a condemnation of the movie, because that's very real to life. It's just a condemnation of life.
So that was
the thing that got me for the movie. But then, of course, the other thing they didn't need is Stitch being dropped into their lives, maybe.
It's said that David, the character, you know, says in the movie, you know, they would have made it if it wasn't for you.
Yeah, Stitch does ruin, like, three jobs at least for Nani.
For Nani, yeah. Including the one we see her at the beginning, where she's working at the restaurant as a waitress.
Yeah.
And, you know, now this, you know, Stitch can't be controlled. I mean, so Stitch is, I mean, that's kind of the thing at the movie. He's a troublemaker. His purpose is to destroy, so that's what he's doing. It's, the, you know, like you said, the nature versus nurture. His nature, as Jumbo programmed him, was to be destructive.
Yeah. And I find one of the most interesting lines is that Lilo immediately understands, if not exactly what he is, she does kind of understand his nature. I think one of the best scenes is when they're sitting in the restaurant while Nani works, and she draws a picture of Stitch, and she goes, here's your badness line. It's way higher than it should be. But I like that it's not 100%. That Lilo still sees that little gap there where goodness can grow. But that she also realizes that something inside of Stitch wants him to be, like, something inside of him is driving him to be bad. It's not all of him, but it is a large part of him at that point. And we see that when we see Stitch in the first scene. You know, where he, like, insults the galactic leader or whatever.
Saying a swear word in an alien language. You can get away with that in a Disney movie.
Yeah, so naughty.
If you make up your own language, you're fine. You can say whatever you want.
Yeah. Quick Conlanger note, this does not appear to be an actual language. It does appear to be more in the Star Wars vein of, it is gibberish, and we just call it an alien language. Anyway, I like that insight that Lilo has on him of like, yes, I see there's a lot of bad in there, but here's the part I want to focus on and work on.
Yeah.
Not the like 95% bad, but the 5% good.
Yep. Let's work on that. Let's make you, as Bubbles say, a model citizen.
Yeah, which I love. I disagree with Lilo's method of trying to make him a model citizen.
Because the example that she uses.
Yeah, fun fact about me, I absolutely loathe Elvis. I do. I'm sorry. I know that we've probably got people, like, clutching their pearls now, but his voice annoys me. Everything about his mannerisms annoy me.
A 14-year-old girl.
Well, yeah, there is that. There's a lot in there problematic about his relationship with women, but I don't really want to get into that. But just as an aesthetic, I've never liked Elvis. Like, not even necessarily as a person, but as an entertainer, it is not for me. I'm glad there are people who enjoy it. If you get enjoyment out of Elvis, please grab whatever enjoyment you can get in this world. But it's not my enjoyment. It's nails on a chalkboard to me. And the fact that this movie is filled with Elvis is like, I love everything about this movie except that. So, you know, it is kind of funny to see him doing like the see Stitch doing like the Vegas Elvis with a ukulele or whatever, but I am exactly the wrong audience for that, my friend. It's not where I'm at. I don't know.
Yeah.
What did you think about that?
I kind of, for someone that young in 2002 to be interested in Elvis Presley is kind of weird, but then again, I'm the kind of kid that my parents raised me up on Motown, so I already knew who, you know.
Yeah, I was raised on Sinatra, so I mean, you know, it's a thing that
Yeah.
maybe her father or mother was really into Elvis. You know, we see her father in the picture is holding the ukulele, so I'm assuming that the ukulele Stitch uses is probably her father's ukulele. But I'm assuming that since it's a record player and everything as well, her father was kind of like a vinyl hipster. Slightly more rare in 2002 than it is now.
Yeah.
It's
Well, we don't know
gone
how old,
mainstream again.
we don't know how old the parents were. To have an 18-year-old daughter, maybe they're already in their 40s, 50s, we don't know.
Well, yeah, and honestly, for 2002, Nani would have been just a couple of years younger than us, like a year or two younger than us. 'Cause 2002, we would have been like, what, like 21?
Yeah.
And she's like 19 probably. So, you know, about 2 years difference. And, you know, our parents would have roughly, I mean, that would have been their generation,
Yeah.
you know, for
No,
our parents. So
it would have worked.
it's
It worked.
very probable that one of her parents was an Elvis fan, and these were that parent's records, and all from their childhood, you know. So these are probably the vintage originals rather than reprints hipster style. So yeah.
So yeah, so you know, Lilo tries to make Stitch the model citizen by modeling him after Elvis, and it's played up for laughs, and it goes horribly wrong. You know, he though Stitch really gets the hang of playing the ukulele almost instantly, which is.
Well, yeah, and we get that it is almost a throwaway line at the beginning when Jumba is praising all the abilities he gave Stitch. But most of them come back into play later in the film. He says that Stitch is impervious to fire, which is used like three times in that final scene. You know, he says that Stitch is calculating enough that he is faster than a supercomputer and has an incredibly intelligent brain, which explains why he picks up English, the ability to read. You know, we see him do things like build an exact model of San Francisco, which he probably flew over, maybe.
Well, there is the one scene where he sees the postcard of San Francisco.
Oh yeah, the postcard. Right. I forgot about that. So he saw a postcard and immediately recreates the image in 3D using random stuff around Lilo's room. And then goes all Godzilla, which I love. A
Because he needs to get.
fun fact, the closed captions describe the music playing in the background right there as King Kong type music, which I'm like, no, wrong kaiju. That's a East Coast kaiju. We're doing West Coast now. This is very much a Godzilla reference. Thank you. But yeah, you know, so we see a lot of that of Stitch learning, and I think the ukulele is just another part of that. That he immediately understands the typical progression of music, the, you know, how to improv, with an instrument, and also the mechanics of working the instrument very, very quickly. Which I like. It's a little character moment that they don't really get into. The one thing I did wonder watching the movie is how stupid are the humans? Because everybody thinks this is a dog.
Well, they do. There's a one throwaway line that Nani says that he may be a koala.
Yeah. But, like, the shelter thinks he's a dog. They'll, instead of going, like, this is obviously not a dog, let's call a wildlife expert and see what we accidentally hit with the truck, they just let Lilo adopt him as a dog. Also, $2 for an adoption fee and pet license?
In 2002?
$2, even in 2002? Yeah, seriously, $2? Are you kidding me? Best shelter ever. Oh my goodness, when I adopted my dog, 3 years ago now, it was, you know, almost $200 after we'd paid for, like, neutering surgery and all the shots we had to get and everything. I mean,
are you sure your dog isn't really a super smart alien?
You know what, if he is, I would love him all the more, so I'm okay with it. But I just love the idea that all of the adult humans are like, yeah, sure, dog. That looks like a dog. Nobody's going to question that it's bright blue. You know, it's like, yes, I know we have dogs that we call blue dogs, but they're like gray. That's, you know, that's what that color really is. You know, it's like, ah, what? Are you kidding me? You know, so yeah.
Cartoon, I guess.
Yeah, I know it's cartoon, but I'm like, come on, everything else is relatively realistic.
Maybe if they made Sis look more like a dog?
Yeah, and he does try to kind of walk like a dog. You know, he gets down on all fours and walks on his knuckles, and he does kind of bow his legs out a little bit like a bulldog or, you know, a pit bull or something like that would walk.
He does bark a few times.
He does bark a few times. Not very well, but, you know, good enough for a human, I guess. I don't know. Mm. And what is it? She said he was a collie before he got hit by a truck. That's Lilo's explanation for why he doesn't look like a normal dog. I love that, that she's just decided, like, yes, in a former life you were a collie, and then you had a horrible accident, and for some reason now you're blue.
A koala. And, a blue koala.
And have an extra set of arms. I adore that kind of conceit, because I do like the trope of, like, humans are too stupid to recognize the obvious alien, but they play into it, of course, with Jumba and Pleakley as well, you know.
Yeah,
Pleakley dressed as the wife of, like, you know, oh, I'm not ugly, you know. It's like,
yeah, they're dressed. Their human disguises wouldn't work normally, but everyone else is okay. They're just people.
Yeah. So I absolutely love it. But you know, we get the kind of comedic thing with Jumba and Pleakley trying to capture Stitch without doing too much damage or reveal themselves to the humans, which is, you know, an old conceit as well. Mm-hmm. This isn't, you know, the first movie by any means to use it. But I love the idea, and of course Bubbles confirms where it came from at the end.
Yeah.
The idea that we can't harm anything on Earth because they are part of the mosquito food chain, and mosquitoes are an endangered species.
We're food for mosquitoes.
Yeah, we are food for mosquitoes, and that is why the humans must be protected. And I love the idea that Bubbles came up with that as, like, a Hail Mary pass for a previous alien incident. Some people claim that he was there for the infamous Roswell incident, but that happened in 1947. And he mentions it being Roswell 1970-something. So it is a different Roswell incident.
That apparently the Councilwoman was there for.
Yeah. You know, Bubbles is older, but he's not that older, you know. No, not the Roswell incident that you're thinking of. That was in the 40s. Bubbles is in another Roswell incident we have never heard of that was in the 70s, and somehow convinced them that they couldn't hurt Earth because mosquitoes. Which, interesting flex there, Bubbles, but okay.
It worked, apparently. And now the aliens believe that Earth is a wildlife preserve for mosquitoes.
Yeah, but, you know, it has kept the aliens away for, like, what, 30 years at that point? So, yeah. You know, that's pretty good. I like that apparently all the aliens in the universe except humans are part of this one galactic federation.
Yeah.
And that they are very, like, rule, you know, because Bubbles says aliens are all about rules, you know. I love that kind of idea that what a hilarious retirement plan Bubbles got. Like, yeah. You saved the Earth. You need to retire from active, like, CIA alien service.
Go to Hawaii.
Go to Hawaii, yeah, which I think is hilariously awesome. And then... We'll give you a job as a social worker, but it's kind of obvious that he's the emergency social worker.
Yeah.
He only shows up if something has gone horribly wrong and nobody else can fix it. Which makes sense in retrospect, because if anybody can fix an unfixable situation, it's going to be the guy who convinced aliens mosquitoes were an endangered species.
Yep.
Which I love everything about that, and I love that the movie doesn't totally spell that out for you, that that's what happened, but if you give it a couple of seconds thought, you do realize that that's what happened. Like, well, where do you want to go in your... In your retirement there, Agent Bubbles. Oh, Hawaii'd be nice, you know, like so
the ultimate problem solver.
Yeah, I do kinda like that. And I do kinda like the idea that he's just chilling around on the beach 90% of his time, and then that 10% there's like, hey look, you know, we got a family that's in serious trouble, come help them.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I love the whole idea of that character.
I have to mention this one, because I think people will be upset if we don't, is Cleekly being a cross-dresser, sort of? Is he one of the few cross-dressing characters in a Disney movie?
I honestly think that this is a reference to Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
I really do, because... Kevin MacDonald was one of the, you know, very much in the Monty Python vein.
Yeah.
It is a comedy
all
troupe, all-male comedy troupe that frequently had to dress up as female characters because there's nobody else there. Kevin MacDonald was one of the frequent ones that got that job in Kids in the Hall because he is more of a slight build and everything, and in a dress looks a little bit more feminine than some of the others. But I honestly read that as a Kids in the Hall throwback joke. I don't know if it was necessarily intended, but the voice he uses for Pleakley as a woman is one of the go-to voices that he always used on Kids in the Hall. So that's why that whole scene just read as a, and this one's for the parents, if you know who's doing this voice. But yeah, I mean, if that is... If you want to read that as an empowering character, by all means, I think Pleakley is a great character. I like he's a bureaucrat, but he's not necessarily an evil bureaucrat. He very quickly realizes he's on the wrong side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And he's torn between that kind of bureaucratic, like, I made a promise to follow this rule, and the realization of sometimes rules need to be more flexible.
Yeah.
You know, we need to have a case-by-case version of this rather than a blanket version, which I think is what the councilwoman at the end also comes to.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, it says, does he really have to go? And again, quick fix with Bubbles, kind of saying, hey, didn't you buy this? Didn't you buy him
the
shelter?
Yeah, giving Lilo the idea of, like, no, you're stealing if you take my dog, because legally he's mine. Which is, I mean, Bubbles for the win, man. Come on.
Quick thinking.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very quick thinking dude. But, you know, the idea that, like, okay, this is the local law, we should also follow the local law.
Yeah.
And also that the councilwoman realizes that this is not an evil creature, despite whatever he was made to do.
Yeah.
That he is now a, and see, before, they couldn't really tell how sentient Stitch was. The best they got out of him was, like, a random swear word, which, you know, I mean, a parrot can do that.
I didn't teach him that.
Yeah, you know, a parrot can literally parrot back, you know, whatever you say. It doesn't mean they actually understand what they're saying.
And it's the end of the film where he says, my name's Stitch. Oh, okay. Well, because of Stitch, wait, what?
Yeah, it, you know, and this is my family, and I want to say goodbye to them. And, you know, and that Stitch isn't fighting anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, before he was acting like a caged animal. Mm-hmm. A caged animal will almost always try to get out of the cage, at least at first. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not necessarily a marker of high sentience that it tried to escape a cage, because any animal will try to escape a cage. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he's like, I understand that there are laws, I understand that there are rules, and at this point, I understand that it could cost me my life, because they were trying to kill him at the beginning of the movie.
Yep.
But I'm going to do it because I want to protect my family, is, you know, the kind of ultimate marker of high sentience at that point. And empathy.
Yeah. It's at the end, you know, he does everything that he does in that third act to save Lilo, because he loves Lilo. He loves Lilo and wants to make sure she's safe.
Yeah, there is destruction that happens, but his goal is no longer to destroy things. That was accidental, you know, or needed. You know, he destroys the tanker to get him into the air to, you know, to get on that. Which, you know, so good. I love Stitch's character arc. I love how he kind of starts learning the thing. And, of course, bringing in the kind of Native Hawaiian idea. You know, Ohana. Yeah. Which was not an original part of the movie. When they were thinking about setting it in Hawaii, they went on a research trip, and apparently their guide, he seemed to know everybody everywhere, and Chris Sanders was like, you know, why do you know them? And he's like, oh, you know, they're Ohana, you know, they're, and he was like, well, it means family, but they're not all my blood relatives. They're just, we're all a family, you know? And he was trying to explain the idea, of this kind of, and I've looked into it before. And it does seem to be, and you know, I have no Hawaiian ancestry. This is me from the outside, you know, doing research on language and culture, but it does seem to have an idea that is mixed up with like being kind to guests and, you know, making sure that everybody has what they need and, you know, just a general idea of caring and looking out for each other and collectivism in that sense. So I like that this term was very important to their parents, especially it seems their father. That their father was constantly reminding them about Ohana and telling them that, you know, Ohana was important. And it does seem that their father was the one who came up with the line, Ohana means family and family means no one is left behind. So I absolutely love that in their research they found a cultural touchstone that they could use to make the movie more impactful and meaningful and share at least a tiny, shallow little understanding of a part of Hawaiian culture with the rest of us.
Yeah, that message, that theme of family took so many people. The idea of the broken family, and it's something that was definitely modern. Disney would never touch something like that before this movie. And it's something that is such ingrained in modern, you know, the original family dynamic of the mother and the father and the child. Not every family has that.
You have
one parent and a child, or maybe it's an uncle or a grandmother or whatever. So to have that, the idea that a broken family is just as good as any other family, touched so many people.
Yeah, what's the line Lilo has about this is our family, it's small and it's broken, but it's still good.
It's still good. Still good.
Yeah.
And Stitch parrots that at the end of the movie, you know, this is my family. I found them. They're small and broken, but it's still good.
Yeah. Which I absolutely think it's so great that they're, you know, Disney has always been the family company. But a lot of people didn't see their family in Disney for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that since in our lifetimes, you know, in our generation, and now continuing for the generations that are, you know, coming after us, that Disney is trying to show, you know,
non-traditional families.
Yeah, more types of families.
For example, first thing I think of is Big Hero 6, where Hero's being raised by his aunt.
Yeah. Or, you know, the idea even of multi-generational families that still live together. In most of America, not all parts of America, of course, but in most of America, at least during our childhood, was very, very rare, the idea of many generations in the same home. It is becoming less rare now just because of, you know, life circumstances. But you know, America is one of the few cultures that isn't a norm. You know, so many other places you would have several generations in the same house. Modern America has not been like that.
It's pretty much you're of a certain age, move out and start your own life.
Yeah, we are a very individualistic culture in at least mainland America. But a lot of things, you know, like a lot of the other cultures we have, you know, assimilated usually by force, did not have that same individualistic idea. They were much more community-oriented and collectivist cultures that we have kind of tried to rip from that. And I wish we hadn't, because as we are now learning, there is worth in community effort.
Now more than ever.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, I mean, we're doing it now. We're giving up things that we love in order to keep the community safe. And again, you see it in Moana, you know, which is set in, you know, the Pacific and all that, not too far has a lot of, even though they're not, you know, native Hawaiians that are in there, that kind of Polynesian, greater Polynesian culture that also extends into Hawaii, is very much about what is good for the community. You know, that's the big conflict in Moana is do I go off and do the thing I want to do, or do I stay here and worry about what the community needs? And she is able to find a balance. You know, is that, and I think that that's kind of what America is relearning, is that there needs to be a balance. You know, everything can't be in service of it's just the community and never the individual. But at the same time, it can't go the other way either. That everything is just about the individual and not about the community. That you've got to find that balance. And I think that Lilo and Stitch shows that too, is that they're worried about defending the community from Lilo, I mean from Stitch. You know, they want to protect Earth from Stitch, but that they realize that Lilo doing her own thing, you know, seeing some worth in this creature, wanting to take him in, saying, you know, putting her foot down and saying, no, he's my family, he is good, he can learn, actually strengthened the whole community. You know, that they didn't have a destructive force anymore. They had a very powerful creative force at that point on their side. And I absolutely love everything about all of the moral messages of this movie. I can't ding it like I have some of the ones we've been over, because I think this is an overall movie whose heart and head are both in the correct spot.
Yeah, and again, it's something that you didn't really see from Disney at this point. And very few Disney movies after this have done storytelling like this. You know,
Yeah.
at least, like you said, to have the head and the heart in the same place, and or in the right place.
Yeah, and you know, I'm very sad I am coming to this movie so late, because it really, you know, I think there are hard parts of my life earlier where this movie could have really been a big impact and a comfort to me, but I'm glad I have it now. You know, I'm
I
glad
mean,
that this gave me an excuse to see something that is now one of my new favorite things.
yeah, and again, it got so popular they did three other movies and three animated series. That's how
And
popular
maybe
these.
we'll deal with those in the future, but today is not that day, my friend.
So let's
So
not.
let's ask the big question for you, because this was a rewatch for you.
I want to do one more thing before.
All
Let's
right. No.
talk a little bit about David, because we haven't talked about him in
Okay,
this
yeah.
movie.
David is adorable. I love everything about David.
It's very, you know, he obviously likes Nani, and Nani obviously likes David, but it's just these two actually want to get together, but the circumstances have never been right in Nani's life, clearly. And, you know.
I think that what David is, I think that Nani is saying, I've got so much to do with Lilo that I, you know, I can't also.
Balance a relationship.
Yeah, and also there are a lot of people, and not just men, but the trope is men, but a lot of people in general who, if their partner already has a child to raise, you know, even in this case where it's not her child, but she is still the mother figure, that they can't really deal with that. They don't want to be into that. I know, you know, I have single parent friends who are like, it's very difficult to find somebody to date you when you have a small child, because most people don't want to come into that dynamic and immediately be not only a romantic partner, but now a parental figure.
And David's all into it. It's just
David seems absolutely fine with being, you know, big brother, pseudo father or whatever to Lilo. He's already very good with Lilo. He wants to be around her. He wants to help Nani do whatever is good, which I think actually I liked that relationship because I didn't feel like he was pushy. I could see where some people might. You know, when he says things like, well, you can repay me by dating me.
He gets her a job.
but he is helpful, and he doesn't seem like he's doing it just in hopes she will date him.
No, he's actually caring about these two people. These two people are mean something to him, you know, Ohana and all. So he wants to help out. In a way, you know, helping out Lilo is helping out Nani. If Nani gets the job, then Lilo is taken care of.
Yeah, and I you can see it because even when he's alone with Stitch, who he doesn't think can talk or understand him, you know, he still is like, I really wanted them to have a chance. He's not like, oh man, there goes my shot at the girl. You know, he's like, this family is about to be torn apart and it kills me.
Yeah.
Which I think really shows that David is a very good guy, you know, and it's very rare you see that kind of surfer dude who's kind of a klutz also be portrayed as just a really good human.
Yeah.
Usually they're kind of, you know, jerks.
Selfish, yeah.
Yeah, but they're kind of selfish, vain jerks. And David has none of that. Which I think, honestly, is just part of having said it in Hawaii. Because in Hawaii, everybody's life revolves around the ocean. So the fact that you're a surfer dude isn't like a special thing. It's just like every other person in Hawaii. You know?
I just like, you know, Lilo's reaction is like, don't worry, you'll have your chance. She likes her butt and fancy hair.
I read her diary. Yeah,
his reaction, like, he doesn't even care about the butt thing because he's like, oh, she thinks my hair is fancy? It's like almost a thing, yeah, I know my butt looks good, girl.
You know, well, also I think it's because he's a poor guy and that haircut probably came from the supercuts down the street and he's probably like, sweet, it looks fancy and not like I spent $10 on it, which is actually what I did. That's kind of how I read that because I've had that before where it's like the cheapest haircut I've ever had in my life and people are like, ooh, what salon did you go to? And I'm like, yes, I went to very expensive salon. It cost me many hundreds of dollars. <It's> like, you know.
All right, so that's all I wanted to say about Dave. So.
David's great. I love David. Bravo, David. I would be very interested in seeing the sequels and see where they go with the David character because I hear he is in them.
Yes.
So
to answer your question, whether this movie still has the magic, I believe so. This movie definitely has the magic on this rewatch. And this is definitely a movie that has stood the test of time, and I think will. I don't know exactly what they're going to do with the remake, if it even happens now, since the world is up in limbo right now.
Yeah, but, everything's kind of up in the air right now.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it definitely. I mean, if you have not seen this movie, I definitely recommend going seeing this movie. In whatever way you can, whether it's Disney Plus or other streaming services or getting the Blu-ray or whatever. This is definitely a movie that, you know, sit with your kids and watch this. You'll enjoy it. Your kids will enjoy it. Great movie.
Yeah, and being that this, you know, I am watching this, like, literally yesterday before we record this, is that this movie does not feel dated at all to me. This movie could have come out yesterday, and I don't think they would have had to have changed the thing.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't feel like this is the early 2000s. We've got a lot of cultural references. We've got, like, really the only cultural reference in this is Elvis, which was already dated by the time they made this. So,
yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of, like, pop culture stuff to get dated. It's a very timeless feeling movie. There's not a lot of technology in there, too. I think really the only human technology we really see is that Nani has a cell phone.
Yeah.
She's talking to David on the phone at one point. But other than that, it's a very stripped down, you know, rural kind of setting. I think they were originally going to put this in like Kansas or Idaho or something in the Midwest.
Small town. Well, that was kind of the whole idea of this is a small town. Stitch cannot get to a big city to destroy it. And that's kind of part of the, that changes Stitch's life.
Yeah. And so I think that this is a beautiful film and it's a great film. And thank you, Adam, for suggesting we do this. This is kind of what I needed right now. It's lovely. And I now, am a huge believer in Lilo and Stitch.
And yes. And the popularity of this movie did get to a sort of attraction as there was Stitch's Great Escape over at Disney World, which now no longer exists, unfortunately. Go see Tony Goldmark's video on that, and you'll know everything you need to know about the attraction. But, hopefully with, you know, whether it's this movie or the remake, that Stitch becomes a more popular character again.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope. And now that it's available, you know, for everybody, this and the sequels and the series and stuff are all on Disney Plus, I believe, now. So, you know, I mean, go have some fun time watching this world and these characters, because they are great.
This is definitely a movie a lot of people need right now because of the theme of family. And right now, everyone needs to be taking care of their Ohana.
Yeah, and if anyone in your family is, you know, neurodiverse on any part of that sort of divergent spectrum, I think they will really love Lilo. I certainly did. I found so much to relate with her, and I think she's a great character. So
yeah, I think that's all we can say on Lilo and Stitch. So yeah, thumbs up, definitely. This is definitely a thumbs up movie.
Definitely go watch. Go watch now. Anyway. So what we got coming up?
Well, 1,000 years ago, superstition and the sword ruled. It was an age of gargoyles, and that's where we're going next week.
Dum 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 da da dum. Yeah,
we're going back into the Disney afternoon, guys.
Yeah, and not just the Disney afternoon, but like the heavy hitter of the Disney afternoon. This thing was Disney's response to Batman the Animated Series.
And how.
Oh, such an interesting thing. So yeah, we're going to be taking you next week through the first 5 episodes of Gargoyles, which were kind of released as a single movie. It is the story of how gargoyles end up in the modern world. We're going to take you through that, and we're probably not going to be alone for that. So tune in next week to see where we go with that.
All right, guys. So tune in next week for Gargoyles. Again, watch Lilo and Stitch if you haven't already. Take care of yourself. Take care of your Ohana. Whoever is your Ohana, take care of them. Check them out.
We are all Ohana now.
Yeah.
The whole world.
The whole world is Ohana. So take care of yourself. Wash your hands, please.
Yeah. Wash your hands. Stay home. Turn on Disney Plus. Listen to some podcasts. Have some good family time. All right. Love you. See you next week.
Aloha.
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.